turn your eyes to the skies. It's time for Spaced Out on 95 BFM, thanks to the Stardome Observatory and Planetarium.
Good afternoon, David Britton from the Stardome.
Good afternoon.
How's it going?
Oh, not too bad. A bit wetter today than usual, but that's a good thing, I think.
Just a bit of rain, because it seems to have been quite dry the last while.
Yeah, we don't have a too dry winter, do we?
No, of course not. It still seems very mild, actually, for basically the very end of May.
Well, yeah, it's a northerly wind. It's quite a bit warmer than what we had a little while ago, but apparently it's going to drop by about 10 degrees in the weekend.
Well, that's
which,
good.
Of course, this part of the course being the long weekend.
Yeah. Funny how that happens. Now, David, this week we're sort of going to be looking at satellites which look back at Earth for reasons of environmental, environmental watch, keeping an eye on how we're caretaking the planet.
Yeah.
Where are we going to kick things off this evening? With SpaceX launching a whole bunch more satellites up?
Yeah, I thought I'd start with that first. So the topic you just mentioned arose last time we talked, where I was asked about how much money is spent on satellites and what benefit they actually provide.
Yeah, for the people down here on Earth.
So I thought I'd just start off with something in the sort of wow factor area, and that is last Friday, SpaceX launched 60 satellites all at once. Each of those satellites weighs about 230 kilograms. Altogether, with all 60 of them, made it the heaviest payload that SpaceX has ever launched, over 13.5 tons, 13,620 kilograms. So they've got 60 of them, and what they're there for is it's the beginning of internet connectivity from space around the world. So they've got 60 of them. If you're reasonably quick, you can go to Heavens Above, the website, and see if it's going to be coming over New Zealand. I haven't had a chance to actually check dates and times myself. But when they're released, they're in a long line, like a string of pearls, going across the sky after dark. They will gradually spread out and get fainter, and so need to get onto that if people want to actually see them. But they're going up to an orbit about 550 kilometres. So that's only the first batch of 60. What they're aiming for, to be able to have a reasonable beginning, what they call minor coverage, would need about 400 of them.
Okay.
For moderate coverage, they need about double that, about 800 operational satellites.
Now, what's the point of internet connectivity up in space?
It works from space, so we can connect on the ground without
without a cable under the sea.
And cables and laser microwave dishes and all that sort of thing. Absolutely. So it's absolutely connectivity worldwide.
Okay.
No matter where you are. But to get their ultimate aim, though, they actually have permission from the Federal Communications Commission to launch nearly 12,000 of them.
Yes.
So, 60 sounds like a lot, and it is, but it's just the first stage. That's the beginning of it, and obviously satellites benefiting us, not straight away. They're actually quite smart. They can automatically avoid collisions with other satellites and space debris. And their orbit isn't too high, so what it means is that eventually, over a period of years, they will burn up in the Earth's atmosphere. So they won't stay up there forever and just clog space up entirely.
Okay.
So they have given a bit of thought to that. So that's an immediate thing that will affect people down here in the near future. I just thought for another example is there was a problem that people found from these satellites that measure gravity of the Earth. And what these two satellites do, that they're in a pair, separated by a couple of hundred kilometres. And when they go over, say, a mountain range, because the mountain range has got more mass and it's sitting on a heavier, denser material underneath, the first satellite will speed up as it goes over the mountain range and then slow down. Then the second satellite will do the same thing, but at a later time. So you can use those measurements of the separation between the two satellites to figure out the gravity below, and therefore you can infer things about the density of the ground and so on. But they can also use it for water.
Yeah, I did a quick little look at this online, and apparently they're doing it to measure the distribution of fresh water and observe changes in...
That's right. Yeah, so the aquifer of lakes and rivers and so on. The satellites have been going for many, many years. They actually stopped in about 2017, but they had the foresight to put a follow-up satellite, so those measurements are still continuing. But what I was looking to talk about, though, is what they found. They measured the height of the ocean, okay? And what they found is over the last umpteen years, the height of the sea has been rising about 3 millimeters per year. But between 2010 and 2011, it suddenly dropped by 5 millimeters.
Oh, did Godzilla come out of the water or what?
They're trying to figure out how can the ocean height drop by 5 millimeters when it's been rising by 3 millimeters every previous year.
Godzilla.
Could it be the ocean's cooling, which would make it shrink? Or is there just less water? And these satellites were able to establish that, in fact, there was less water. And what had happened was that La Nina, the oscillation in the Southern Ocean in the climate with the water temperature, it created so much rain over Australia, Southeast Asia, and North South America that the oceans, because their water had evaporated and gone into rain and then onto the ground, onto the continents, water in the oceans had become less, but the total hadn't changed. The water had been
redistributed
on the ground.
Yes.
Yeah. And so after 2012, they were able to confirm that the previous trend resumed.
The sea levels went back to rising.
Well, that's right. And yes. It still is. And that's from climate change. It's just amazing that they're measuring in millimeters of the ocean height, having to eliminated all the other perturbations and effects on the height of the ocean. So it's one example of satellite Earth observation. So in science, Earth observation obviously is done from the Earth as well. I mean, you measure an earthquake, you measure the height using lasers and all sorts of things, you measure the temperature of the air and so on. But satellite Earth observation takes it to another level, of course, and it's a huge business. I mean, satellite services revenues in 2017 were about $130 billion.
Yeah, it's not just government agencies getting into this. This is private enterprise,
right,
which is sending up most
amazing
of these satellites.
Yeah, satellite manufacturing, $15 billion. Ground equipment, $120 billion. So if you compare that with NASA's budget. NASA, people point the finger and say, oh, why are they doing that? You know, it should be feeding starving millions. NASA's budget for 2019 is $21.5 billion.
Holy hell!
Okay, so $21.5 billion is a lot of money, sure. But when you compare that with $128 for satellite services and $119 billion for ground equipment, you know, it's still a small amount. And that's only a small percentage of the budget, about less than 0.5% of the U.S. National budget. And NASA's never spent a huge amount after the Apollo years I'm talking about.
Of course.
The last time it was even near 1% was in 1993-94 when it got to 1.01% of the national budget. So, I mean, the value for money that NASA and ESA and the other space agencies provide is just absolutely amazing. NASA, in fact, as a public relations exercise, which they continue to this day, produce a publication called Spinoff, which you can access quite easily, just Google it. And that's been going for like 30, 40 years. and it lists all the different things, not just in satellites, but the other spin-offs and technology in the space area, and rocketry and looking after people in space and so on. So yeah, the benefits are just amazing. From forecasting the weather, of course, biodiversity, wildlife, land use change, like deforestation,
yeah,
for
of
instance.
Course. That's a big one, isn't it?
Managing natural resources, you already mentioned fresh water, even disease and so on, that can be even tracked from space, believe it or not.
Amazing, amazing. Now, some students have managed to shoot a rocket into space and it's reached space. No mean feat?
Well, my students, these are undergraduate university students. It was their fourth attempt. They had to design, build, and launch the rocket. So there was no mentor. They had mentors who would answer questions or whatever, but they couldn't actually do the work. The undergraduates had to do it. There were 80 of them. This from the University of Southern California. They got their rocket to 103.6 kilometres, maximum speed of about 5,500 kilometres an hour. So when you get above 100 kilometres, it's called the Kármán line, that's the default altitude to say that something has reached space. So to really be called an astronaut, you've got to get above 100 kilometres. You don't have to stay up there, just go up and come back down. But if you've done that, you can definitely say you've been to space. So that they did that, and they're the first to ever do that for undergraduate
Did they get any photos?
Yeah,
did they get any photos for the flat earthers out there?
I don't know if there are any flat earthers in that project. Probably none.
I'm saying, did they get any photos for the flat earthers out there?
Oh, photos, sorry. I don't know. This was just the announcement and the initial information after the success, because they recovered the rocket and it came back down.
Oh, fantastic.
Didn't think to put a camera on it or anything?
It looks like the rocket was about 3 meters tall, and they've made a fairly simple frame for firing it out looking at the photo on the internet.
They obviously didn't cram a student in there, like the worst performing student, and just shoot them on into space.
I mean, basically, you need something to get the rocket moving in a straight line up.
Mm.
Once it's doing that, the rocket will then take over staying going upwards. So you don't need anything too fancy. But they did need something more than just the rocket standing there, because it's lighter than the big ones you see, like Rocket Lab launching from Mahia Peninsula.
Yeah, of course.
Mm.
Now, Scorpio, is it Scorpio, has its eye on Orion. What does that mean?
Well, after sunset, we're at that time of the year when Scorpius is coming up
Scorpius.
In the east. So after sunset over in the east, you'll see the hook, Maui's fish hook, or the scorpion. Scorpion's upside down, of course, with the tail facing down instead of upwards. But if you then look to the west where the sun has just gone down, you'll see Orion very low near the horizon. So we can see both of them right now. One in the west, one in the east. And basically the story goes that Orion doesn't like Scorpius. Scorpion's after Orion the hunter. And so over the coming days and weeks, Orion will gradually disappear and Scorpius will get higher and higher and higher. So our winter big constellation is Scorpius. Our summer constellation is Orion. So mm-hmm. It's the changing of the seasons there. If you're up in the morning before sunrise, if you've got a good low horizon in the east, around about 3rd or 4th of June, you'll be the first to be able to see Matariki rising again. It's been too close to the sun for the last 6 weeks. But 3rd or 4th of June, it's just, if you're right on the east coast somewhere looking over the Pacific Ocean on a really clear morning, get to see that before the sun comes up. Every day will get higher and further away from the sun and easier to see, of course.
Nice.
The Matariki Festival will be in June. The festival itself is on the 22nd of June, but the time of the Maori New Year begins on the 5th of June with the new moon following the appearance of Matariki.
And you guys will obviously be doing a couple of Matariki-related things at the Stardome?
Absolutely. We've got our regular show, Matariki Dawn. They've got a lot of information about Matariki and how it was used to correct the lunar calendar. The Maori had the ancient Maori had a lunar calendar, and because the moon cycle doesn't sync with the Earth going around the sun in the year, you need something to fix that, and that's what Matariki is used for. So you can learn about that. There's also three great stories. There's the creation myth in that show. There's the story of Rona and Marama, how the moon phases began, and also the story of the great Waka in the sky. That's a really good show to see. So that's Wednesday through to Sunday at 7 o'clock for the whole of June. That's Matariki Dawn.
Oh, fantastic. Now, just quickly, one last thing before we wrap up. Someone has texted in and they have just asked, can anyone just fire a rocket into a space, or do you need permission?
You need permission.
You need permission?
I mean, Rocket Lab, they had to jump through all sorts of hoops with the US federal agency. That's part of the reason why Rocket Lab has its headquarters in the United States, because it makes it easier to jump through the hoops that you need to. New Zealand started a space agency to help with that endeavour, and also to get a space-based industry going in New Zealand. I mean, if you're a rogue country or whatever, no, it's very hard to stop you doing something like
or
that.
Or a rogue suburb of Auckland.
That's what I like to hear, actually. That's what I like to hear.
Yeah, you're going to be in really deep hot water, though, if you do something like that. In New Zealand, it's actually harder to launch, like, even the smaller rockets, the ones powered by chemical engines, than it is in the States. You can just buy those rocket engines from department stores, States.
Willy-nilly.
You can't do that here at all.
I actually heard a cool fact as well, that New Zealand has the highest amount of, what would you say, rocket scientists per capita in the world.
Oh, well, probably, but they're probably all working for Rocket Lab, I suspect.
Yeah, but it's still a cool fact, right?
Yeah, well, absolutely, and that number's going up all the time, so the ratio is going to improve as well. Just one thing before I go, and I just mentioned Matariki Night Sky. This is a new one we have. It's at 4 o'clock on Saturday and Sunday through June. So this is for the younger people, so if they're after a little more of the youngest family-friendly tour of the stars and the constellations around the time of Matariki. That's a new show. 4 o'clock Saturday and Sunday, that's the weekend. Matariki Dawn, the longer, more possibly more advanced, I suppose, but it's still family oriented. That's Wednesday to Sunday at 7 p.m. At Stardome.
All right. Hey, thank you very much, David, from the Stardome at Planetarium and Observatory.
See you in a couple of weeks.
Got it, bro.
Cheers, mate. Bye.
Control, we are docked. That was Spaced Out on 95 BFM, thanks to the Stardome Observatory and Planetarium.